We'll call our brother Jeff, and he'll lead us in a study on Isaiah.
Evening, everyone. So last week we spent some time looking at the first couple of chapters and drew out some, at least I think they were, exhortational points for us to take home and take to heart. And we spent most of our time in Isaiah, and tonight I'd like to go kind of all over the place, but base our thoughts mostly on actually chapter 4. And I kind of had chapter 3 and 4 read because, well, we'd read chapter 1 last week, and I know y'all went home and read chapter 2 during the week. And we talked about chapter 2 a fair bit, about the hope that it has. And in chapter 3, it kind of echoes again some of the ideas that we talked about that come through in the first chapter about the attitude of the people. And to kind of try and sum it up a little bit, I know you weren't all there here last week. There was a lack of sincerity in the hearts of the people that we take out of looking at chapter 1, verse 4, for example. A sinful nation, a people loaded with guilt, and children given to corruption. Yet on the other hand, they were children of God, and they were called by God. And so we were looking at those two aspects. One, they were this rebellious people, but they were called and privileged to hear this call. And all they had to do was realize that and turn around again. And really drawing the parallel to ourselves and with the realization that not one of us is perfect. And that we could all be called the people loaded with guilt. And yet, what do we do? Do we forsake and turn our back? Because that's what verse 4 talks about. They've spurned the Holy One of Israel. And then that comes out also in chapter 3 that we just read. Chapter 3 that we just read. In verse 9. After verse 8, the Jerusalem staggers and has fallen. In verse 9, the look on their faces testifies against them, and they parade their sin like Sodom. So what could be more like turning their back on God than being proud of the fact that they've done this against his will, and they do not hide it, the end of verse 9. They have brought disaster upon themselves. So then the rest of the chapter talks about one thing you can pull out of this is it talks about all the great things that they've achieved for themselves, and yet what does it amount to at the end? Your men will fall by the sword, your warriors in battle. The gates of Zion will lament and mourn. Destitute, she will sit on the ground because there's nothing left, because there is no hope in the way they're going. So our path, it's everything. And we always have to be thinking, well, is this the path that takes me really where I want to go? And lift our gaze up beyond the immediate and beyond the now to see, well, what's coming if I continue in this way? And so there's a huge importance in the sincerity of the works of the people, because we realized that in again, in chapter 1, about the middle, around verses 12 to 15, they were making offerings, but they were meaningless and they were empty. There was nothing in them that appealed to God. In fact, he says, "I'm weary of bearing them, and I'm not even going to hear your prayers." Why? Because they didn't have their hearts open to learn and to seek to do right. They weren't sincere. And so it comes out in verse 18, a well-known verse, "Come now, let us reason together." And that's where we have to really pivot on this thought. Is what we're doing now reasonable in terms of our salvation, in terms of the example for others that they might also have hope? That our sins will be as scarlet. And though our sins are as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though red as crimson, they shall be like wool. So that's where we're coming from. And in chapter 3, there's a similar idea of the importance of our works, but with a sincere heart, because otherwise it's empty. And it boils down to all this finery in verse 18 that the Lord will snatch away, and it doesn't come with us, and it doesn't help us on our walk. And so, following on from chapter 3, and of course there weren't any chapters at the time Isaiah was written, it seems logical to continue from verse 26 in chapter 3 to on to chapter 4. In that day, seven women will take hold of one man. It's in the same vein. Take away our disgrace, and then we start a new section again of hope. So, from chapter 1, there's a lot of condemnation. In chapter 2, there's a glimmer of hope. There's some judgment. And then we come into chapter 3, and the judgment continues on the acts of the people, which really are coming from their hearts, right? Because what we do in life and what we dedicate ourselves is evident, or what we dedicate our hearts to becomes evident in what our priorities are in life. And the priorities of the people of Israel were very evident. And so, where do we want to go tonight with that 10-minute introduction? And I think it is with hope. And the point that I want us to think about is God is all-powerful. Do we believe it? And we're going to go to a number of places in a number of different references to affirm his power. Now, in verse 1 in chapter 4, is this maybe when the people begin to realize that there is a hope? In that day, seven women will take hold of one man and say, "We will eat our own food and provide our own clothes. Only let us be called by your name. Take away our disgrace." They don't want to be in this situation anymore. When we realize that we've gone so far down a path that we shouldn't have, is this maybe our reaction when we consider and begin to reason together? That, okay, we've gone too far. Please let us just be called by your name. Let us just be called, once again, children of God, and take away our disgrace. And this is the hope that begins to come out in verses 2 to 6 of chapter 4 afterwards. I'd like to go to Jeremiah chapter 6 for a moment. Now, at this time, Jerusalem is also in trouble, shall we say, under siege. And it begins, flee for safety, people of Benjamin, flee from Jerusalem, sound the trumpet in Tekoa, raise the signal. And listing the names to verse 2, I will destroy the daughter of Zion, so beautiful and delicate. Verse 4, prepare for battle against her, arise, let us attack at noon, but alas, the daylight is fading and the shadows of evening grow long. So arise, let us attack at night and destroy her fortresses. Cut down the trees, build siege ramps against it. The city must be punished. It is filled with oppression. Verse 10, to whom can I speak and give warning? Who will listen to me? Their ears are so closed, they cannot hear. The word of the Lord is offensive to them. They find no pleasure in it. Verse 16, stand at a crossroads and look. Ask for the ancient paths. Ask where the good way is and walk in it, and you will find rest for your souls. But you said, we will not walk in it. I appointed watchmen over you and said, listen to the sound of the trumpet. But you said, we will not listen. Chapter 7, verse 4. Do not trust in deceptive words and say, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. If you really change your ways and your actions and deal with each other justly, if you do not oppress the alien, fatherless, and widow, and goes on to talk about their sincerity. In fact, these words are come out in the New Testament as well, and in the context of the temple of the day of the temple of Herod. In the days of Jesus, when they're admiring this temple and Jerusalem, and really it didn't have sincerity attached to it at all. You see this great temple, it's coming down. Don't put your trust in the physical temple. Put your trust in God. Put your trust in me. And this is, of course, Christ, paraphrased somewhat. So, I don't know what you come up against with in. I'm just thinking about our daily lives and the opportunities that we have to speak about what we believe. And what other people's reactions are to our beliefs and to what we think, to our hope. Because you can kind of read in these words in Jeremiah. And you hear echoed back to you sometimes, we will not walk in it. I've heard, but I won't listen. And going back to verse 15 of chapter 6, are they ashamed of their loathsome conduct? No, they have no shame at all. They do not even know how to blush. Some, so they will fall among the fallen and be brought down when I punish them. So the call of God means that we need to be listening. And I mentioned what are others' reactions because it comes back to me. And I think, well, if I also can't talk about what I believe, and I can't tell my neighbor, and I can't admit that, yeah, I believe in God and I believe in the Bible, If I'm not prepared to say that, then I'm not listening either. So I think these difficult words of Jeremiah can be taken very, very personally, and whatever our own personal struggles are, they can help us. They can motivate us to, again, set aside our natural reactions and really think about what is reasonable. In other words, really think, what does this situation I'm in right now compare to the eternity that God has prepared me for, that He wants to prepare me for? So ears, closed ears, is what we find in Jeremiah as well, another prophet who struggled to bring his message to the people. And I think, and we talked about Isaiah, just as much Jeremiah wanted the people to listen. And here's an example of someone who he's not just preaching this thinking, these people just don't know anything and I'm so frustrated with them. He's frustrated with them because he wants them to understand this message of hope and love it as he does. And they don't want to. And so let that also be our motivation, that it's something that we treasure and we really want others to find it a treasure. So I want to go into Matthew 14 for a moment. I think it's, no, yes, it's Matthew 14. I'm in Mark. And this is the account of John the Baptist being beheaded. Now, here's an example of someone in extreme pressures. Although, at this point, what could John do about it? He had said his piece. He knew where that his life was on the balance. He was held by Herod. And it seems that Herod kind of liked to hear what he had to say, and he actually seemed to respect him. But when it came time to save face before the people, well, we know what happens, because on Herod's birthday, the daughter of Herodias danced for them and pleased Herod so much. What does he do? Makes a really silly promise to give her anything she asks for, up to half the kingdom. Or is it half the kingdom? No, it doesn't say half the kingdom, does it? Maybe it says in another place. I do not remember. It says that he promised with an oath to give her whatever she asked. That sounds like half the kingdom, doesn't it? Whatever she asked. That, wow. Give me here on a platter the head of John the Baptist is what she asks for. Well, she must have had quite the stomach, for one, but imagine just even having the gall to ask for something like that. Give me someone's head on a plate. And she knew full well, her mother knew full well, that this was not going to please Herod. So, what does verse 5 say? It says, Herod wanted to kill John, but he was afraid of the people because they considered him a prophet. So again, he's trying to save face. Pretty consistent. He doesn't want to kill John and get him out of the way for saying all these things against him. Well, because the people will get upset. And now, well, he's got no choice. He's made a promise. He's going to give away his kingdom? No, he's just going to bring someone's head on a plate. Interesting, though. Come over to Mark chapter 6. chapter 6, verse 19 and 20. So Herodias nursed a grudge against John and wanted to kill him, but she was not able to do so because Herod feared John and protected him, knowing him to be a righteous and holy man. When Herod heard John, he was greatly puzzled, yet he liked to listen to him. Bit of a different angle here in Mark than in Matthew, which simply says Herod wanted to kill him, but he was afraid of the people. And in verse 19 of Mark 6, it's Herodias who really wanted some way that she could invent to knock John off out of the picture. So it was Herod's position of respect and power, so to speak, that he really valued the most, it seems. If we come back over to Matthew chapter 14, verses 9 and 10, again, the king is distressed, but why? Because of his oaths and his dinner guests. So he ordered it be granted, and he had John beheaded in prison. So again, it was about saving face. And it's interesting to note that the king was distressed in verse 9 in Matthew 14. He was actually distressed, but because of the oath, he went ahead with it. Mark chapter 8, verse 38 says this. I'll just read it for you. If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with his holy angels. I can think of times when I should have said something and I haven't. John said all that he could till his head came off. Herod was afraid of saying anything wrong because he wanted to keep his position in power. Come over again to Mark 10, verse 45. For even the Son of Man did not come to serve, or to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. You know, that's what we've got to start thinking about, is what is our motivation, and why are we doing what we're doing? If Christ died, he gave his life for this, what can we do to show how much we appreciate this gift that we don't deserve? Matthew 15, verse 13. Every plant that my heavenly Father has not planted will be pulled up by the roots. So have we been planted? Are we children of God? And really the question is more of where are our roots, and where have we really decided to grow? And on what? The prophet Isaiah, with all his heart and soul, wanted the people to have their roots deep in God's word, in the call that he offered them. But they weren't, and many were pulled up by the roots because the roots didn't go anywhere. Or maybe you can think of it this way. It implies a complete end, really. You take a plant and you pull it up by the roots and it's going to die. It's dead. It has nothing to sustain it any longer. is just going to dry up and shrivel up and fertilize the next plants. It's a total end. And the roots are the support for the plant. And so you can think of a total end of this kind of thinking and behavior. That something that God doesn't desire is going to be completely torn up. And if your roots are deep in the world, well, the whole world will be uprooted someday. In Jeremiah and Isaiah, we read of the hard consequences for many in Israel, in Jerusalem, that wouldn't listen and that completely turned their back and were proud of what they had done. I imagine a person like Herodias was just thrilled to find a way to take the life of a man. Whether he deserved it or not, she didn't like him. So where are our roots? And where is our confidence? Matthew 19 is close by, so verse 26. Who then can be saved is the question from the disciples when they realize that, well, those with riches don't necessarily find it easy. In other words, it's not the way you think. They're not blessed by God because they're rich. And so they have a free ticket. And who then can be saved? If this thinking is wrong, with man this is impossible, but with God all things are possible. Back in Genesis 18:14, it says, "Is anything too difficult for the Lord?" Do you remember when that was? That was with Abraham. The rest of the verse reads, "And at the appointed time, I will return to you at this time next year, and Sarah will have a son." And he put his confidence in God. The Lord said to Moses in Numbers 11:23, "Is the Lord's power limited? Now you shall see whether my word will come true for you or not." Job 42, verse 2, "I know you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted." Psalm 3, verse 8, "Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing will be upon your people." And the Psalms are full of this sentiment in Psalm 62, verse 11, "Once God has spoken, twice I have heard this, that power belongs to God." And Jeremiah 32:27, "Behold, I am the Lord, the God of all flesh. Is anything too difficult for me?" And we could go on. There's a long list of verses that talk about God's power, his might, and where we see impossibility and give up, perhaps. We don't know really what's around the corner. But if we can place our confidence in God, we know that he will carry us through. The one that I always like is Matthew 24:35, which says, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." Now, we may be asked, what do we want, even though God knows? Matthew 20, verse 20. Why do I say that? Well, it Matthew 20? No, it's the end of the chapter. It must be verse 30, yes. Verse 30, we have two blind men sitting by the roadside, and when they heard Jesus was going by, they shouted, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." The crowd rebuked them and told them to be quiet, and they shouted all the louder, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." And what does Jesus ask them? "What do you want me to do for you?" So there are two blind men here that appear to have some faith. They could have asked for money or some other thing, but they believe that Jesus can heal them. And they say, "We want our sight." Very interesting. They asked for their sight, but that also Jesus asked them what it was that they wanted. And he asks them this, and they fully, with full confidence, say, "We want to receive our sight." Come also then to Mark. We're talking about belief. Mark chapter 9. Coming in at verse 14. This is the healing of the boy who has this evil spirit, as it's put. And when they came to the other disciples in verse 14, it says, they saw a large crowd around them, and the teachers of the law arguing with them. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. "What are you arguing with them about?" he asked. The man in the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought my son, who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of his speech. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him on the ground and he foams at the mouth." So he has a boy and he's thrown into these fits of perhaps epilepsy, and the disciples can't fix it. And what does he say? "O unbelieving generation," in verse 19, "how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." And so they brought him. Now, come down to verse 23, or 22. It's the boy's father speaking, and he's explaining what happens. It has often thrown him into the fire or water to kill him, but "If you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." And Jesus asks him, "If you can?" Everything is possible for him who believes. And immediately the boy's father exclaimed, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." So we come back to belief and confidence. And I think of the attitude of the blind man. I think of this man who brings the boy to Christ. And I think of the opposite end of the scale of the people in Isaiah 1 and Isaiah 3 who've turned their backs, who've committed their sins and put it out there because this is the way they are, and you're going to take it because this is who I am. Compared to this plea from a man who knows he's wrong, who knows he just doesn't quite have it all, and doesn't this describe us at times when we feel we just need that extra something? "I do believe," and we do believe. "Help my unbelief." And so there are two things to remember. Come back to Isaiah for a moment. And it comes again out of chapter 1, verse 17. Learn to do right. And how do we learn? We learn by listening. And what do we listen to? That's where our roots are. Come now, let us reason together. And I'll read this to you, don't have to go there again. In Jeremiah chapter 6. Ask where the good way is and walk in it, and you will find rest for your souls. I appointed watchmen over you and said, listen to the sound of the trumpet, and you said you will not listen. But if we do listen, if we do hear, then we will see that God is merciful. And if we believe, we will pray. And if we believe, we know that our prayers are heard. If we believe, we know that our prayers are answered. And for this reason, I think it is that Jesus says in Mark 9, verse 29, this kind can only come by prayer. Speaking of the fact that the disciples couldn't drive it out, and he says, this kind can only come out by prayer. Well, isn't prayer linked to our belief, to our confidence in our God, to the fact that he is all-powerful and can do anything? If we're willing, because he's not going to force us to choose the right way. We have to make that choice. And so what is our hope and our joy? Is it not to be ready to receive Christ when he comes? Ready to be there in that day. Verse 2 of chapter 4 of Isaiah, in that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land will be the pride and glory of the survivors in Israel. What a contrast. I mean, we could go all through Isaiah from talking about the branch. The obvious passage in Isaiah 11, verse 1, that a shoot will come up out of the stump of Jesse, and the roots a branch, and from his roots a branch will bear fruit. Many more passages that come out of Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Zechariah. Isaiah 60, verse 21 says, then will all your people be righteous, and they will possess the land forever. They are the shoot I have planted, the work of my hands for the display of my splendor. Now, isn't that interesting? The word that is used in Isaiah 60, verse 21, is the shoot that I have planted. But every plant that's not planted by God is uprooted. It's gone. It's dead. But these are the shoots I have planted. These are the ones that take confidence in me, that have placed their trust in me. And they are the work of my hands. And they display my splendor. Why? Because that's where we want to be. Again from Isaiah chapter 27, verse 6. Just a moment. Speaking of fruit, and the root of Jacob. In the days to come, Jacob will take root, and Israel will bud and blossom and fill all the world with fruit. And back to Isaiah chapter 10. Verse 20. In that day, the remnant of Israel, the survivors of the house of Jacob, will no longer rely on him who struck them down, but will truly rely on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. A remnant will return. A remnant of Jacob will return to the mighty God. So when we come back to Isaiah 4, and we look again at verses 5 and 6, the Lord will create all over Mount Zion and over those who assemble there a cloud of smoke by day and a glow of flaming fire by night. Over all the glory will be a canopy. It will be a shelter and a shade from the heat of the day and a refuge and a hiding place from the storm and the rain. I don't know what that reminds you of, but it reminds me of Exodus, when the people, starting in chapter 13, it begins to talk about the cloud that would lead them by day and the pillar of fire by night. And it's repeated in chapter 13 and chapter 14, all the way through to the end of Exodus in chapter 40, where it was that the cloud would settle on the tabernacle, and the glory of the Lord would be there. And then when it lifted, they would continue their journey. A small picture of the kingdom of God. But more than that, it was something for them, a sign that would help them to trust. Imagine having this to guide you by day and night. Imagine having this pillar that went before you in the desert, and fire at night. It must have been quite a sight to see. And so it makes me think about, okay, well, what in our lives can we picture in front of us? What has God done that we can look back and think, this really has impacted me? And not just me, those around me. Is this my pillar of fire or of cloud that's guiding me? Certainly, we can find something in our own lives that has been powerful, that has shaped what we've done, that we can maybe look back and think, this really is a message to me. Psalm 85, verse 9. Talks about the confidence, again, that we can have in our God. Psalm 85. Surely his salvation is near those who fear him, that his glory may dwell in our land. And this is the picture of the glory of God dwelling in this tabernacle among the people. And yet we're to remember that it's not in temples that he dwells. It's in us. And how is it in us? It's in us as much as we reflect his character. We've spent a bit of time as well in Matthew, so just Actually, no. I'm going to go to Isaiah 40:34, just as we close up. Sorry, Isaiah 32, a chapter that speaks of a king reigning in righteousness from the beginning. And verse 2, each man will be like a shelter from the wind and a refuge from the storm, like streams of water in the desert in the shadow of a great rock on a thirsty land. Verse 18, though hail flattens the forest and the city is leveled completely, how blessed you will be, sowing your seed by every stream and letting your cattle and donkeys range free. My people, verse 18, will live in a peaceful dwelling and secure homes in undisturbed places of rest. Verse 17, the fruit of righteousness will be peace. Verse 16, justice will dwell in the desert. And this is the picture of being planted in the right place. And you think of the refuge from the storm aspect, and you can't help but kind of also draw a parallel to Christ's parables of the house and what it's built on. Built on the rock or built in the sand. And where are our roots? And is God our refuge and our shield? Is he our only option? Is he really our hope and our joy and our confidence? And if we really believe that God can do anything, then we can't believe as Herod did and just enjoy listening. I enjoyed listening to John. And we can't just hear. If we really believe that God can do anything, then it will show. And if we really believe that he can do anything, then our love for him will grow. And if we do really believe, then he will bring us into his kingdom. Thanks.